I am your temporary chair. This is the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. This morning, our chair is testifying in another committee. She will be joining us shortly. We have a number of things to hear this morning. I'm going to take them a little bit out of order and first open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 5A. Administrator, would you like to tell us about?
Senate Bill 5A deletes required membership of numbers of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, the Legislative Council Committee, and the Legislative Administration Committee. It provides that a quorum for transacting business in those committees, plus the committee for issuing the education funding report pursuant to Article 8, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, is a majority of House members and a majority of Senate members. It requires affirmative vote of a majority of House members and a majority of Senate members for action. You have the dash A2 from Senator Courtney. It deletes the required membership numbers of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, and it provides that a quorum of transacting business is a majority of House members and a majority of Senate members. It requires an affirmative vote of a majority of House members and a majority of Senate members for action.
Okay. And who we got?
I think we have Senator Courtney.
Senator Courtney, would you like to come forward? And
Speaker Merkley is there, too. I think he's testifying on this.
Oh, and Speaker Merkley, I didn't see you.
Would you want to go with him first?
I was going to bring you both up here at the same time. You're on a different...
Yeah,
oh, okay.
I apologize.
Back.
Madam Chair, I'll step back and him go first.
No, he is on a different issue.
So I know that. I'm trying to...
You're trying to tell me that.
The rules and regulations of the House.
Welcome.
Welcome. It's really nice to have you.
Welcome, Mr. President. Please proceed.
My name is Peter Courtney. I represent District 11, Senate District 11, which includes Woodburn, Jervis, parts of Salem. And I live at 2925 Island View Drive North in Salem at 97303. Vice Chair Berger, Vice Chair Buckley, and members of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules, thank you for letting me come here today and testify on Senate Bill 5A. This bill will enable a couple of simple but necessary changes to the structure of statutory legislative committees. It applies to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology, the Special Joint Legislative Committee on Section 8, Article 8 of the Oregon Constitution, and Legislative Council Committee, the Legislative Administration Committee, and the Joint Legislative Audits Committee. So it applies to all those committees. It makes similar changes to these legislative committees as Senate Bill 371 does to the emergency board. And I don't know where 371 is over here. I don't know where it's going, whether it's going to be in a committee. And maybe it is in this committee. I don't know what you're going to do with it, but it makes similar changes. The bill removes statutory designations of the number of committee members. This corrects the imbalance that exists on some committees, such as Legislative Administration Committee, where by statute there are 4 House members and 3 Senate members. I just realized this is not a great audience to be talking to about that. But the fact is, in law, there are designated, this shall be the number of House members, this should be the number of Senate members, as does exist, by the way, in the emergency board. This legislation also changes the method of determining quorums for each committee. Senate Bill 5A provides that a quorum for each committee is the majority of House members and a majority of Senate members. Now, that I could go off on. I feel very strongly about that, and I'll go off on that in a minute, but I just want to say it for the record. Perhaps most importantly, this bill is intended to clean up the inconsistencies of voting procedures which currently vary from committee to committee. For example, current statute stipulates that the Legislative Administration Committee takes action upon the affirmative vote of the majority of members from each House who serve as members of the committee, while the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology takes action upon the affirmative vote of the majority of the members of the committee. Senate Bill 5A cleans up this inconsistency by requiring an affirmative vote of the majority of both the House and the Senate members for actions to be taken by each committee. And then finally, I also would submit to 5A, this amendment, it is an amendment that corrects an oversight from the original bill that makes the same changes to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee as were made to the other statutory legislative committee. So basically, I learned all this once because of my e-board experiences, and I was bothered by it. And even though it worked against me as a member of the minority party when I was on the board, I always said that if I ever got a shot at it, I was going to correct the situation where it was a majority of whoever's on the committee, regardless of Democrat, Republican. I don't care for that. I oppose that. I think it should be in these joint committees. You have to have a majority of the House members, and you have to have a majority of the Senate members in order for a bill or action to take place. And from a quorum standpoint, it has to be, you have to, in order to have a quorum, you got to have a majority of the House members there, and you got to have a majority of the Senate members there. And this is what this is all about. I want it in statute. I think it should be in statute. The numbers issue, you know, it's only because if you look at Ways and Means right now, this is the biggest Ways and Means we've ever had in the history of the world. I got more than two-thirds of the Senate on Ways and Means. I didn't realize until I looked at it the other day, because I'm not sure that's the smartest move I've made. But the fact is that these kinds of committees are going to become much more important than they are now as we get into an annual session, assuming we pull off this experiment. They really are. You talk about legislative council, legislative administration, those kinds of committees. And I'm not sure we should have in statute there can only be this number of House members and this number of Senate members. I think it should be left up to the presiding officers who work with their groups. So I'm speaking generally now, but I think this is an important piece of legislation. The Senate thought it was an important piece of legislation. They passed it out on a very bipartisan vote. I think there were one or two. There were some dissenting members. I don't know what the vote was, but it was pretty large. So there you are, Vice Chair Berger. That's what this bill is all about. It attempts to speak to quorums, to try to speak to affirmative votes, and speaks to numbers of people that are on these committees. All these committees are statutory. They exist in statute. Unlike, for example, a Senate Committee on Transportation. It's not a statutory committee. A Senate Committee on Health Policy. It's not a statutory committee. So with that, thank you very much for at least letting me come here and speak. And appreciate you letting me have this moment. I think I filed with each of you written testimony. I always like to do that, a written testimony. Tried not to read from it, did read from it, but I also tried to speak extemporaneously or spontaneously, whatever you say, after I spoke, reading from the transcript, which you're never supposed to do. Questions, comments, criticisms, whatever
you
want to do with
me. Committee members, questions? Well, I have a couple. These are softballs. Ways and Means, I'm trying to go through which are the statutory committees. Ways and Means, Audits Committee, and Legislative Council Committee, are those the only three?
Legislative Administration. Legislative Council, Joint Information and Management Technology, Ways and Means, E-Board, another bill. I think that's it.
And if I could.
Education funding.
In all of these cases, they would be under this new system. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They would all be consistent in that a quorum consists of a quorum of House members and a quorum of Senate members, and an affirmative vote would be an affirmative vote of the House members and an affirmative vote. So they would all be consistent in this. Is that what basic proposal is?
Yes, Chair Berger. And the number designations now,
which are statutory,
would be there. For example, can you? Could I just? You got one here? Just give me a committee that has a statutory. I'm talking about. Let me just, if I could. 173.730, committee membership statutory. This is the Legislative Administration Committee. Legislative Administration Committee shall consist of the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate, four members of the House appointed by the Speaker, and three members of the Senate appointed by the Senate President. Those kinds of designations will now be taken out of the bill, taken out of the law if this passes. There would be no designation as to the numbers.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. That's what I want to affirm. In other words, it would be up to the presiding officers to absolutely designate, and is it your vision that they would be the same number of House and Senate members? But that would be up to the presiding officers?
Chair Berger, I think they should be equal. That's what Peter thinks. I think they should be equal. That's what I'd like to see. But I also think it should be up to the judgment of your presiding officers, because otherwise, for example, we are using a much larger Ways and Means Committee than we've ever used before, if you understand what I'm saying. But there is no numbers in Ways and Means, thankfully. But there is a bill before you to increase the amount of number of people who are on e-board. There is a number that, you know. So I think it should be left up to the presiding officer, but I would be hopeful that whatever they do, they would have equal numbers on all these committees.
But Vice Chair Berger, did you have
a... Can I push you this one more time? Just a little bit further. Senator Courtney, I'm a little bothered by the ability of future presiding officers, not anyone current, of course, to manipulate this in, for instance, the Legislative Council Committee. If the numbers are wide open, I could foresee some issue around Legislative Council that was real important to the presiding officers and them saying, oh, well, we'll take care of this issue by only appointing, say, two members, and thereby absolutely controlling what Legislative Council, you know, any dissenting voice on that committee. I could foresee that as a possibility if there's no reference to how many, because by having a certain amount designated, and whether it's even or not is another argument, but then you've got to appoint five or four or some number, so presumably there would be a contrary voice in that. But if you could go down to just two members, you could make sure there were no contrary voices on that committee.
Well, Vice Chair Berger, that would be an egregious action. There's no question about it. I can't deny that. That would be an egregious action by a presiding officer. I suppose that could happen. You know, and of course, if that bothers you in this committee enough, I assume that you will decide to do something about it. I do think we have entered an era in terms of the legislature, as I now view it, composed when I came here in 81, that more legislators, not fewer, want to be involved in this process at all levels. That is my opinion of what has happened. And I think these numbers limit, these designations limit that kind of participation. That's my view. But I will fully admit you ask a very pointed and important question, and that truly possibly could happen, and that would be going the other direction, and that would be egregious. So I don't know what else to do but say that to you.
Thank you.
Madam
Chair? Yes. Other questions, Vice Chair Buckley.
Hi, Madam Chair. Senator and Representative Brewer, isn't that balanced out, though, by the idea that a bill could only move forward by a majority vote of the Senate members and the House members?
Chair Rosenbaum, no, because as long as you had the two members of the Senate were there, and they were lockstep, and they showed up together, and they always voted together, you'd have the judge. I assume that's what would happen. So I have to admit, one of those senators fell away, you got serious problems. But as long as they're there, they are a quorum of their numbers, and they're a quorum of the affirmative vote, yes. Majority of the affirmative vote, yes, excuse me.
Other questions from committee members for these witnesses? Thank you very much,
Thank
Senator.
You. Well,
I apologize for being late.
That's fine.
And I see that we have Representative Merkley, the Speaker of the House, in the room. Would you like to come forward? Oh, you're here on a different bill? You're not here on Senate Bill 5?
I'm not there.
Oh, all right. Then could you please just stand at least for a moment?
Sorry, I forgot to warn you. I did that, too.
we have only in work session.
We put in that bill. No less than that. Yeah.
All right. Then I will close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 5A. And I'll open a public hearing and work session on, I think these are both related, so on both Senate Concurrent Resolution 10 and Senate Joint Memorial 7. And now, Representative Merkley, would you like to come forward? Good morning, and welcome to the Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and it's a pleasure to be here to testify before your committee. State Representative Jeff Merkley from District 47, Speaker of the House, for the record. Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify on these two measures before you. They are of great importance to our heritage. Taken together, these two measures honor our past and plead for our present. They acknowledge mistakes that we have made, and they implore us to not do further damage. The Wyam people, or Wyampun, have lived at what we know as Salilo Falls since at least 9,000 years before Christ. Cited at one of the world's most auspicious fishing locations, the Wyampun prospered both from the river's gifts and from the far-ranging trade that radiated from Salilo Falls. The westward expansion of the United States, however, caused some serious hardships for the Wyampun, the worst of which occurred 50 years ago when the salmon fishing at Salilo Falls ended, flooded out by the Dalles Dam. This background sets the stage for the two measures that you have before you. Senate Joint Memorial 7 urges Congress to fund housing restoration at Salilo Village. This village where the Wyampun now live is on federal land that was set aside subsequent to the flooding of the falls. The land is there for use, but the fishing and thus the ability of this community to thrive has been forever diminished. Congress has appropriated 3 years' worth of funds for the restoration of the village, and the Wyampun have been temporarily relocated while construction at the village continues. But if Congress does not renew the funds, the relocation could become permanent, and that is not acceptable. Congress needs to act, and we need to encourage Congress to act. The second measure, Senate Concurrent Resolution 10, honors our past with an acknowledgement that the loss of Salilo Falls 50 years ago was a tragedy. The falls, or Wyam, Wyampun are named for the falls, and shows how closely integrated the story of this community is with this feature, this benevolent fishing grounds. So the falls was a major hub in the Northwest by Native people for thousands of years, and people came there to fish and trade. And the sudden silencing of the falls on March 10th, 1957, these are falls that had thundered there since the beginning of times, still reverberates through the daily lives of the Wyam people. More than just a falls was drowned, an entire way of life, one that existed in the same form for thousands of years, drowned that day also. So it's only right that now, with this memorial, we recognize the loss and learn lessons that we can carry into the future. So I encourage the committee to thoughtfully ponder both this memorial and this resolution and send them on to the full House. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for this witness? Okay, thanks very much for being here and for kicking off this hearing. And next we'll call Sean Cruz. And Sean, was there anybody you wanted to bring forward with you? Or?
Yeah, these two members of the tribes.
Okay, yeah. And that would be Elizabeth Woody and Linda George...
Mianis.
Mianis. Would you like to come forward as well? Good morning. Welcome to the Elections Committee.
Thank you. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cruz. I'm Senator Abel Gordley's Chief of Staff. It's an honor to be here today to speak to these important measures. There is a dash one to SCR 10 that is should be arriving here, we hope, by 9 o'clock, and I just have to take responsibility for not getting this done sooner. There was a couple of drafting errors in the original document. I'd like to read into the record Senator Gordley's floor speech, which contains the corrected language. And that way we can not perpetuate a disrespect that these people have been living. And I also would like to just connect the two measures and just explain how they're related. When SCR 10 came to the Senate floor on March 12th, Senator Gordley's remarks read like this. SCR 10 mourns the flooding of Celilo Falls in 1957 and its loss to the tribal people of Oregon. The destruction of Celilo Falls, one of the great natural, cultural, and religious wonders of the world, ended a way of life that had endured and prospered for thousands of years. The resolution reads, whereas Wyom, the Great Falls of Nichiawana, known to us as Celilo Falls of the Columbia River, thundered for millennia in the spiritual heart of the Northwest and was a natural wonder of the world. And whereas throughout the millennia, Celilo Falls was the primary place where native people caught the giant Chinook, blueback, and coho salmon that struggled upstream through the rocky barrier of tumbling waters and swift narrow channels. The native people's record of habitation proves Wyom to be one of the longest continuously inhabited communities on this continent. And whereas for its thousands of years of human civilization, Wyom was one of the world's great marketplaces, and a half dozen tribes had permanent villages near the falls where some 5,000 people would gather to trade, feast, and participate in games and religious ceremonies. And whereas the multitudes of salmon caught at Celilo Falls helped make the lower Columbia River among the wealthiest places in what is now the United States and fostered a blossoming of rock art culminating in the petroglyph Tsagalali Galalo, or She Who Watches, and other great works. And whereas the images of the dip netters reaching from their vibrating scaffolds into the roiling river are an icon of the native Northwest. And whereas on March 10th, 1957, the waters held back by the Dalles Dam flooded and silenced the awesome and sacred roar of Celilo Falls, severing a great spiritual connection between the Creator, Mother Earth, and the native peoples of Oregon. And whereas the silence of the dead falls is rivaled only by the silence in the hearts of the elders who remember the thunder of the falls and the vibrant community struck down by the dam. And whereas the tribes of the Columbia River and the people of Celilo Village will hold a memorial for Celilo Falls on March 10th, 2007. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon that we, the members of the 74th Legislative Assembly, mourn the flooding of Celilo Falls and recognize the falls' great importance to the native peoples of Oregon in providing sustenance from the salmon and a gathering place for all tribes, and agree to observe a moment of silence on March 10th, 2007. And be it further resolved that a copy of this resolution shall be presented to the Tribal Council of the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, the Tribal Council of the Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon, the Tribal Council of the Nez Perce Tribe, to the Wyom Board, and to the Tribal Council of the Confederate Tribes and Bands of the Yakima Nation. Regarding Senate Joint Memorial 7, Senator Gordley's statement, the destruction of Celilo Falls also destroyed the homes of the Wyom people who had inhabited the site for thousands of years, creating great hardship and great injustice. At the time of the destruction of the falls, promises were made to the Wyom people by the federal government to replace the housing that was lost, and those promises were not kept. Now, 50 years later, SJM 7 urges Congress to continue to fund housing restoration to benefit the Wyom people at Celilo Village until completion. And with that, the additional point I would want to make is that the promises were not to the Wyom people were not just made by the federal people that are on the other side of the continent, but they were made by Oregonians as well. And so this is an opportunity to work towards creating a great injustice. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And just to clarify, so there is a dash one amendment on its way to SCR 10. SJM 7 is ready to go as it is then?
Yes, Madam Chair, yes it is.
Great. Okay, thanks for your testimony. Any questions? Perhaps we'll hear from the entire panel and then open it up for questions. And so please go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to speak. I'm a Confederated Tribes, Warm Springs Tribal member.
Could you please just identify yourself for
Elizabeth
our record?
Woody. My name is Elizabeth Woody, and I reside in Portland, Oregon. My heritage is Wasco, as well as Wayampum, and Malith Lama, which is people of the Hot Springs. And my clan on my Navajo side is Bitterwater. And what these signify to most people when you do your introductions through protocol, it tells people where your parents are from and where your grandparents are from. And that gives you an idea of your location and your relationship to the land and to and between us. YM was more than just a physical location. It was a place that provided the people with a great deal of sustenance spiritually. And when people came here from other places, it was probably one of the most remembered and visited locations in the United States. And the reason that I know this, because it wasn't taught in the school system, is because I spent a great deal of my professional life as a writer and as an artist, you know, doing research and investigating the loss of Celilo for one, but also the type of occurrences that happen between peoples that leads to our present day tensions and our present day prosperity. I mean, we have a lot that give and take between all the tribes that were there as well as the people who came. Now, Celilo is it's also known as Celilo Falls. And one of the things I think that my grandmother and grandfather used to say, that if you knew these things, to fish, to hunt, to do the gathering, the seasonal rounds, you would be instructed through the wisdom of the elders and the wisdom of the earth. And that's the connection that people feel the strongest about, which still continue, even though the physical location is gone. And these activities are more than just activities. They're rights and responsibilities that the tribes retained through the Treaty of 1855. And the Treaty of 1855 basically is a contract between our nations and the United States, which at that time was only in existence for, 150 years, maybe. Very short-lived country. So I think that the lessons that we learned from the loss of Celilo is ones that our future will unravel. When I go and teach and lecture at different universities, the most predominant question from the younger generation is, why would such a thing happen to such a beautiful, beautiful landmark? And the answer is, of course, quite wrong. And depending on which stance you take, the reengineering of the Columbia River was intended to provide an inland seaport in Idaho and to provide a transportation for products from the interior to the coast. So that's part of it. The other part of it is that we secondarily added on the need for hydroelectric power. The dams were not created primarily for hydroelectricity. They were created for navigability. So that now that we are in a different age, those type of things will change. We'll have different ways of transporting goods. Our economy will need to change because of the price of gasoline. We'll be purchasing items closer to home within your food shed. So, I mean, these are the kind of things that I think we look forward to, and these are the kind of things we learned from the past. If the people learned to live well within their means, within their geography, and without great impact or detriment. So those are the things that I think about when I think about Celilo, than just its physical location. My relative Linda actually lived there and has a lot of other types of memories there from the community that I think are important to remember. So when you pass a resolution like this, you're giving respect, but you're also helping people understand and open the door for people to learn. And I think that's probably one of the most profound aspects of this last year, has been the kind of learning and exchange that's been going on between communities. And I think that the healing and the kind of understanding that's developed has been very, very beneficial. So, thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Please go ahead, and please just tell us your name for the record, and then go ahead.
My name is Linda George Mianis. I am YM Warm Springs in Yakima. I grew up most of my life at Salado. My great-grandparents was Chief Tommy Thompson and my grandmother, Flora. When I was young, my grandmother didn't want me to watch the flooding, the inundation of the flooding, so they put me in Catholic school, but they still showed it on TV. I went to Catholic school at Merrillhurst. When they showed it on TV, it was just like I was being there. So when we lose something we love, we have to do the traditional way of cutting our hair. And when we die, they use our hair for a pillow. But for me, I still grieve from it. It hurts so much. Excuse me. this was something our Creator had given us to live by, to love what was given to us. And sometimes, we try to bring the memories back of what we had. All our elders still grieve of it. But we survivors, so we'll always be surviving what was lost to us. And I know sometimes, they call it progress. Well, if it was progress, why else are people suffering from it? But when my great grandfather died at 104, this is what he didn't want, was to have the Dalles Dam built. He just wanted our salmon back. But before the Dalles Dam was built, we used to have 10,000 to 100,000 fish come over the falls. But when they built the Dalles Dam, that many fish didn't come over. So they fixed it in a way that we've always wanted and so need, is our salmon. And it's our spiritual. It's our medicine that we need. But we still survive, no matter what you do. But hopefully that you will pass this. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We really appreciate you being here today and sharing your memories with us. Are there any questions for the panel? Yes, Vice Chair Baker.
Not a question, Madam Chair, but a comment. I guess I want you to know that you weren't the only ones who felt your loss. My father, I grew up in Salem, and when I was mere 7 years old in the summer of 1956, my father made a special trip with his family. He said, "You have to see this in your lifetime because it will disappear." And I remember vividly going to your falls, and it was a trip of respect for my family.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Berger, for sharing that. All right, thank you very much for being here, and I am confident that we will be moving these forward as soon as we get the amendments.
So. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we do have two more witnesses signed up, and they are Michael Mason and Phil Donovan. Would you like to come forward?
Yep. Thank you.
Sean said that was your program.
And hold on for just a moment. Sean, is the amendment supposed to be brought here, or do we need to go pick it up? Okay, that's great. Thank you. Good morning, and welcome to the Elections Committee. And please go ahead.
Maybe they can talk long enough.
Yeah, you can just keep talking.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, and members of the committee. Michael Mason here, and I don't have much to add. I did want to just say on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Tribal Council that they very much appreciate your action on this and your consideration, and You know, I guess I would just say that one of the things that strikes me the most about the people is how they deal with and survive this loss. In talking with elders in particular about this, they have. When you talk about the amendment that you're looking at, which partly takes away the word, deletes the word perpetual, because the works of man are not perpetual. The Dalles Dam will not stand forever, any more than our civilization will stand forever, much as we may wish it. When you talk with the elders about this, they say, we don't even want to talk about that. We don't even want to talk about the Dalles Dam going away. The falls is gone, and you're just, you know, ripping into this wound again to even talk about this. So it's a gives you a little sense of how painful it was to lose this place that, you know, I don't remember it honestly, but that you could feel, even driving to it, you could feel it before you could hear it. So again, I wanted to give to the regrets of Louis Pitt Jr., who wanted to be here but is ill, just to again say thank you that this does show that our people are coming to understand really what we have been doing and how we've changed the Columbia River from this wonderful creation into a human thing much more. So thank you again, and urge your support for the resolution and the memorial.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, which consists of the Cayuse, Walla Walla, and Umatilla tribes. I want to first start off by thanking Speaker Merkley for taking the time to come and present this morning, and also to thank Senator Gordley, whose sincerity on the issue is of great value to the people of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I also want to thank this body for the important recognition of marking the 50-year anniversary of Celilo Falls and its inundation. And specifically, I also want to take a moment to talk about Senate Joint Memorial 7. There was a lot of media coverage about the village itself this past spring, and so hopefully you were able to see some of that. Hopefully you understand that, you know, this is literally a village that has been sandwiched between the railroad tracks and the bluffs, and yet the village itself still has a power of itself, despite the fact that the housing conditions are dilapidated. We're talking about World War II vintage housing that needs to be replaced. The good news is that funding has been secured last year and this year to improve the conditions, and yet the job will not be done. We will be seeking an appropriation from Congress of $6.4 million for next year. And so that's the importance of Senate Joint Memorial 7, is to help bring this to, hopefully for that of Celilo Village, to bring this to some closure. That will not be the end. There are still what are called in-lieu sites after Celilo is concluded that will need redevelopment as well. But our focus at this time is Celilo Village, and we thank you very much for the care and consideration of this committee.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you for being
thank
here.
You.
And we do have one more witness signed up to testify, and I see also that the amendment has arrived. So, members, you have copies of that as well. And we will call Jim Stembridge.
Yeah.
Please join us at the witness table.
Members, I just wanted to say that I believe this is a pretty special area of the world, the area near Celilo Falls, and I realized that on my living room wall there was an original drawing, a map made by Lewis and Clark expedition. And on that map, which I have because it shows where the John Day and the Deschutes River come into the Columbia, just downstream, just off my map, is Celilo Falls. And on the map, there is a little notation down here that talks about the height of the falls. It says 37 feet 8 inches. I can't remember the name of the person who actually did this. William Clark did many of these maps. I don't know if this is one of William Clark's maps or not. But this will give you an idea. I was trying to figure out where exactly these falls were. I didn't get to Oregon until 1958 was the soonest I got here. So when I came with my family, we did not see this area. So I don't have any specific memories of that area. But I did also find some postcards on the web, and I'd like to pass these around. Show and tell day. So these are postcards. They show the original. They show the canal that bypassed the falls for a number of years. And then the last one of the pictures shows the lake that is there now behind the reservoir. So let me hand these to Representative Thatcher, and maybe she'll pass them along. And thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for sharing these images. And the map is certainly very special, so we're glad to have those additions. And members, we are there any comments before we? I guess we can take a motion since we are in a work session. Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Joint Memorial 7 to the floor with a to adopt recommendation.
And Representative Buckley has moved Senate Joint Memorial 7 to the floor with a to pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay.
I was just going to say, you know, I grew up in Northern Washington and have a number of relatives and good friends in different tribes there. And having hiked the Elwha River and the number of falls there and the dam that we're eventually going to take out, hopefully in the next few years on that river, to open it up again, it's pretty remarkable to me. And I know most people, if you've lived and hiked a lot, finding a waterfall of any kind is just kind of a special moment. And you wonder about it, and you wonder about how, you know, was this the fall that stopped the salmon from going up the river? Where was that impediment that nature put in the way? And then you find out that sometimes the ones you think no fish could get over that, and then you find out, oh yeah, they used to get over there all the time. And so it's kind of like this amazing homing instinct of people, and our connection to water is so important. And so I was a young kid in 1957 in Port Angeles, Washington, and the news covered this event, the building of these dams and all that kind of stuff. And I remember the events being covered, but I don't have real good recollections of the falls going away. And it was only later when I saw pictures and other things that I realized how amazing this was. And I took my son back to Syracuse Law School, and we stopped by Niagara Falls just because I wanted to see this falls. And when I was there, I kept thinking, you know, we had something like this. It's not the same, but something very much with that water, the rushing, the ways that we won't have again, probably in my lifetime. And so it is a pleasure to be able to look at this. And I commend Senator Gordley for taking the time to do this.
Thank you for your comments. And Shana, please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. And who would like to carry Senate Joint Memorial 7 on the floor?
Any one of them.
Representative Roblin?
Sure.
We would be pleased to have you. Okay, and we are also in a work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 10. And we have an amendment, a dash one, which is in front of you.
Madam Chair.
Okay, I'll go.
Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I would move the dash one amendment to Senate Concurrent Resolution 10.
Vice Chair Berger has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Concurrent Resolution 10. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there objection? Okay, the amendment is adopted. And Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Concurrent Resolution 10 as amended to the floor with a do adopt.
And
recommendation?
Right. And Vice Chair Berger has moved SCR 10 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there discussion? And members, I would just like to say that I think
the loss of Celilo Falls is a tremendous loss to all of us in the state of Oregon, and we do really very much appreciate Senator Gordley and those who have come today to share their memories and to tell us of the importance of this. I think it's, you know, it's a regret that we all have and something that we very much want to remember and acknowledge its great importance. So we thank you for being here today. And Shauna, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
I'm sorry, we were discussing.
We're voting on this.
Aye.
President Brolin?
Aye.
President Thatcher?
Aye.
President Berger?
Aye. Excused? Aye. Motion carries. Representative Berger, would you like to carry this on the floor?
I would be honored to carry this.
Okay, we will move these both forward, and we will let you know when they are going to be heard on the floor. Thank you very much for being here today, and I will close the public hearing and work session on SCR 10 and Senate Joint Memorial 7. And members, we do have one more item of business today, and that is our change to the House rules that's been proposed. However, when we set this for a time certain of 9:30, we had forgotten the fact that there's an extremely important signing ceremony going out on the steps at exactly that time. And so I think what we will do is recess our committee for now and then reconvene at about 5 o'clock today to take that up. Hopefully you can all be here at that time, and I'll give you a little more time to think about it. Okay? Any comments?
Back in this room. We believe
in
we'll be in this
room.
If we're not in this room, we will post it outside and tell you which room we're in. It'll be real close by if it's not here.
Okay, so we will see. How long do you anticipate the meeting? I think that may depend somewhat on whether we have. It is really a work session. I think it's posted for. Is that right, Jim?
Just a work session.
It's only a work session. If we do have legislators who show up to testify, it would be my intent to allow them to testify, of course. But if we don't have a lot of testimony, I don't anticipate it will take very long. So, unless the committee members have a great deal of discussion. So you have some control over that. Okay, well, then, if there's nothing further to come before us, we are in recess. The House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules for May 9th, our 5 p.m. hearing. And members, I will open a work session on the proposed amendment to the House rules. Members, I'll turn it over to Mr. Stembridge.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, the procedure on this is similar to as if it was a bill. We have the original item, and then we also have a proposed amendment. The original proposed amendment is signed by the Speaker. This is the amendment to House rules, and it amends the House rules to establish a procedure and sanction for a member's failure to vote. It requires that a member who fails to vote be given a second chance to vote, then be read the rules sanction provision and given a third opportunity to vote. It requires that the vote of a member who refuses to vote be placed on the record as a yes vote, and that the member be assessed a fine of $5,000 to be automatically deducted from the member's services and supplies account. You have an amendment that comes from the chair of the committee, and I believe I will let her describe how it changes the original proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. And yes, members, I have placed in front of you, dated May 9th, a proposed amendment to the House rules. And this actually is works off of the original change that was placed out on members' desks, deletes the subsections 2 and 3, although it preserves some of what's in those, and then replaces them with a new section 2 and 3. I want to point out before I go into those that section 1 is unchanged in this version, so there's really almost a scrivener's change in that. That really would still be part of this. So essentially what this version that I put in front of you does is preserves the proposal that if someone refuses to vote, their vote will be called on for a second and then a third time. If they've still failed to vote, then the speaker would read a statement that would do two things. One would say that the failure to vote will be counted as an I vote, or as in here it says a yay vote, and then that there will also be a call, well, not a call for, but there will be a censure that happens automatically upon the speaker reading this, and that that will be recorded in the journal. And a censure is basically an official reprimand. This is common in legislative bodies. I have done some research on this working with the chief clerk. We have looked at what other states do in similar situations, and this is something that's used in some other states. So, you know, it's obviously not as serious as expulsion or some of the other penalties that could accrue. This version also says that the member may also be subject to other penalties as the House may order. Those would obviously have to be deliberated on, but at least the censure would happen immediately and be recorded. So I have placed that in front of you. I have discussed this with the speaker, so he is aware of it. Yes, Representative Hunt.
So just to clarify, this version includes no fine, correct?
That is correct. I think based on feedback from a number of people on and off this committee, we decided to eliminate that from the proposal. Is there discussion? Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I think, Madam Chair, I thought that we were going to maybe have a couple of options, two, three, maybe even four options, but evidently, and we should have had the opportunity, I feel, to bring forth something that we wanted. I didn't know that we were going to move this thing right away. I thought we were going to discuss this, figure out, and give the bodies, both sides, out there an opportunity to take a look and see what they think. Personally, I like the Maine, the one from Maine itself. I think it's great because if the individual after, and we're fine up to the point of where they've failed to vote, I don't think a not voting should be construed as a yes vote or a no vote. We talk about the double majority in this building that if you don't vote, it's a no vote, and we resent that. No different than saying it's a yes vote. I think that we need to make this to where it's something that we can all agree upon and not just put this out here and say we're going to do a work session today. Maine is very good in the aspect that it's almost like a shunning. If you refuse to vote, you cannot address that house. You cannot, at that point, speak to the members, nor can you vote until you publicly apologize to that body. That's pretty good. They've never had it happen, but in fact, most states didn't. Arizona also adopted that from Maine. So I think that may be a very good path that I would like to at least let the rest of the body jump into.
And I appreciate your comments, Representative Esquivel. I guess we did not have quite the same understanding because this was posted for a work session, and I had assumed that's what it was. I'm not quite sure how we would be putting multiple versions of proposals in front of the House, because what normally happens is that a proposal is put out, referred to this committee. We consider that proposal, we either accept it or change it or reject it, and then that's our recommendation is what goes back to the full body. So I think, you know, if there were other versions that people wanted to put forward, this would be the time to do that. Is there other discussion? Yes,
yeah, question.
Mr. Berger.
Twice here in this, it says a member may also be subject to other penalties if the House may order.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the mechanism for that or what it means is.
Well, and under the House rules and also under the Constitution, there is a provision in the Constitution for members to be disciplined by the body.
And so essentially the House or the Senate, as the case may be, has the authority to consider penalties that they want to impose. Presumably, if there were other penalties considered, that probably those would come before this committee or some special committee set up to do that. So that really is a reference to the ability that anybody has to impose penalties. I mean, those penalties could probably be up to expulsion. Expulsion under the Constitution requires a two-thirds vote in order to be imposed. Other things are not so specific. So,
Can I ask, is this kind of language elsewhere in our rules? The member may also be, somebody might be subject to penalties as the House may order. Would it be unique to this section? Is there any place else in our, I mean, I hate to tell you, but I haven't got them memorized.
You know, and actually, I wonder if the chief clerk is monitoring this hearing, if perhaps she might want to come and
it would hear be
some
helpful
with us. Yeah, and maybe we could give a call up there. Because I did actually develop this language in consultation with the chief clerk after looking at what some other states have.
And we do have a copy of the rules of the House here, but I don't know that's going
to work. And I don't have my glasses, but if the chief clerk were happened to be here, I wouldn't need my glasses. I know that I can see that they're written, and I do apologize for not, you know. But I just wondered about this
that language.
Yeah, well, because it's so ill-defined, and I just wondered if maybe it wasn't in there other times and other places, and Ramona would know where when it might have been. Oh, there she is. Desperately.
Yes,
please come forward.
You guys did something while I was riding the elevator.
Yes, good evening and welcome to the Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee. We are looking at a proposed amendment to the House rules, as you know, since I think you've been watching our hearing. And perhaps, Mr. Berger,
do you have the language in front of you?
I do not.
Do we have an extra
copy?
Perhaps if she had one, I would be real specific. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ramona, in both of these section languages at the end, it says the member may also be subject to other penalties as the House may order. My question was twofold. One, is this kind of language else other places in the rules, and what does it mean?
Yes, and please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my name is Ramona Kennedy. I'm the Chief Clerk and Parliamentarian for the House of Representatives. That would be in Oregon. Basically, we have in several different sections in the rules where that if someone violates a particular section of a rule, that there is a process by where that may be referred most typically to this committee. And with a number of signatures or with a formal complaint, then this committee, the Rules Committee, would take up that and would then either deem it a valid complaint and move forward taking action, or they may just dismiss it. But the authority lies with typically in all sessions the Rules Committee to make those decisions. This particular language here was taken from other states where that if in fact someone violates the rules, there is typically a process and in some cases a direct punishment. And that's what you find here before you when you talk about the automatic censure for the violation. However, if a member, let's say, makes a habit of refusing to vote, or if, you know, the circumstances present themselves, it leaves an opportunity for then this committee or the speaker to direct a special committee that might be formed to take up any other potential penalties that they would suggest to the floor of the House. And it would only be the House that would be able to impose those penalties. It wouldn't be left to one individual or to a committee, but it would be a decision of the House.
And one previous session here in Oregon was in the 1985 session, when we did have a member whose credentials were challenged and who was not seated the first day of session, but the Credentials Committee did an investigation of that. It was really the Judiciary Committee at this time that looked at those violations, and then after a week deemed that the member should be seated but censured. And then they left it up to the constituency to decide ultimately what might happen to the member. As it turned out, the constituency started a recall petition, and the individual was recalled within a couple months. But, again, I think that, you know, you could provide some clarification that subject to other penalties as the House may order, you might suggest, you know, and language could be added to this where that the after review of the Rules Committee, whatever you call it, that session.
May I pursue this?
Yes.
Go ahead. So I guess that's the heart of my question. By what mechanism would the House order such a thing? And can I? Because I have a lot of questions.
Sure, please. We clerk here to look.
Censure sounds awful, but what exactly is it, except is it a vote of censure, or is it how does censure happen?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, censure in Oregon has been a statement that has been entered in the journal. It has identified the violation of the rule. It basically uses language that suggests that it is there's some adjectives that could be added to that language. I think that if this language was adopted, probably we would want to look at and maybe put in the House procedures and personnel handbook what that language might look like if somebody were to be censured due to failure or refusal to vote. But I have several examples of what that might look like that could be incorporated into sort of a process. Again, it's an automatic censure, and basically, if you go to the dictionary, censure is basically a reprimand. In the legislative bodies, it's a high punishment. I mean, the Constitution states that a member could be censured and or expelled, so it is just short of expulsion. Although it takes two-thirds to expel, it only takes a majority to censure. But by putting it in the House rules as an automatic censure, there's really no vote to be taken. And I think the intent behind this language was that it's obviously done in the public eye. It is done, obviously, within the all members are witnessing this on the floor, that should a due process be provided for them to justify their actions when they are intentionally violating the rule. Rules seemed a little bit unnecessary for this particular violation.
Mr. Berger?
Can I proceed further?
Please, yeah. Go ahead. I read through the NCSL issues, and I think, like Representative Esquivel, I was taken with this punishment of not being able to vote or speak. But, of course, the language says, until the member has made satisfaction to the House, and that's another one of those poorly defined things. What is satisfaction of the House? Do you have any thoughts on, I mean, censure sounds bad to me, but I haven't been there when somebody was censured. It's old language, so I'm not sure what it is. But I frankly am extremely bothered by this. A vote being recorded is a yay when it isn't a vote. I have huge heartburn over that. So I guess I'm looking for some other thing to replace that has real need in it, and the inability to speak
or vote, can we even do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, as you saw in the NCSL and the sort of the collection of the data that we had collected, and this is one reason why I came down to the committee, in that that is the rule in Maine, and it also has been adopted now in Arizona, and it has been used where a member refused to vote in Maine, and they were required. They were not recognized. They could not vote until they came before the body, and they publicly apologized to the body and to the public for violation of an intentional or blatant violation of the House rules. And that member finally did do that because basically, as you know, we do this in a huge open forum, as it should be. And the press that this individual had received was ongoing and ongoing and ongoing, and just the pressure behind that certainly caused a quick apology. So that's how it's been, you know, managed. Only one state, and that would be Wyoming, has the rule that if they refuse to vote, that it shall be recorded as an aye vote or a yay vote. I researched that at great length, having some concerns not unlike yours. The only case law that I could find on this issue was local government case law. There is nothing in the legislative where the courts have gone behind what the rules adopted have been. And in checking with my counterparts in several of the states that serves on Mason's Manual Legislative Commission with me, both lawyers clearly believed that the courts would not, if you put into the rules that it shall be recorded as an aye vote, that the courts would not get involved in that process, that whoever refuses to vote would know prior to refusing that their vote is an aye, should they choose to go down that path. It's not like it happens after the fact. It is already a predetermined vote by their refusal. Now, again, whether it's good policy for the House, whether it is the rules that you want to adopt or not, will be decisions that you need to make. But I did try really, really hard to make sure that it would meet, you know, the courts, that it would be constitutional and that you could do it. Again, you know, any court could obviously decide to get involved. But their sense was that given their long-term history, and they've been in the process as long as I have, that they probably would not. I hope that's answered some of your questions.
One more, Madam Chair.
Sure, please.
This is important. The main example where they're not allowed to speak or vote until they've made, does that run up against constitutional issues around speech? And, I mean, the same question could be asked of that.
Right. I mean, that was the question I had, because I had always understood that under the Oregon Constitution, members had an obligation to vote. I mean, for the same reason that even if you have a conflict, you vote and our rules don't allow abstentions, I guess.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, first of all, the history lesson, if I might, is that before we had Oregon had in its rules the ability to abstain, okay, with permission of the body. They had to ask permission, and they had to get a vote on that. And that rule came out of our House rules during the rewrite of late 1990s, okay? So it was in our rules if somebody wanted to request for that. I had never seen it done. But it was there. And since it hadn't ever been done, the decision by the House Management Work Group at that time decided to take it out. So there was a provision in our House rules. The Constitution doesn't require that you vote. It is our House rules that requires you to vote. And because our House rules are granted through the constitutional provision that each house shall decide their rules of proceedings. That's what gives it that constitutional weight. And that's when you take your oath of office, that you'll uphold the Constitution of U.S. and Oregon. By not voting, you're in violation of your oath, and therefore the constitutional right, or the constitution provision that allows you to set your own rules of proceedings. As far as being able to speak and vote, again, that's under your purview. If you believe that that is really the punishment that is appropriate for this type of violation, then that's clearly up to you as to whether or not you want to proceed that way. Now, we talked a little bit about public apology. You know, having been raised in a family of eight, you know, some of us knew that all we had to do is say, oh, I'm really sorry. You probably have had kids and had that same sort of look, body language that said, yeah, I'm not, but, you know, I've said my words. Mm-hmm. And then you have those that are sincerely sorry. I don't know how you get around that, except for, again, it's a very open process. And clearly, not only are the constituency watching, but so is the press. But other than that, I think that, again, not only this rule, and now I'm probably speaking a little out of turn, but not only this rule, but every rule of the House should be honored. And I take great, it pains me when somebody, a member of the House, intentionally violates the House rules. And it's not like you didn't know that this rule was in place or that you forgot, but if somebody reminds you, i.e., that you need to comply with this rule, and then you defy that, is when I believe it becomes intentional. Okay, there's a difference between, you know, having to be reminded of a rule, i.e., your best friend is not family, okay, or, you know, that you can only have one person on the floor at one time. I'm trying to think of some light things here. But, you know, for you to turn to the sergeant-at-arms and say, well, I don't care, I'll have as many people as I want, I think that becomes intentional because you've been reminded about what the rules are. So, again, I think that for a violation of any rule, specifically when it becomes intentional, deserves some sort of very deserves consequences appropriate to the violation.
Representative, did that?
Yeah, I'm thinking now.
Okay.
Food for thought.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the main issue, my other issue there is, how do you record their non-vote? And if they proceed to not vote, do you know how Maine records those? I mean, what does that show up on?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I have not checked with the Chief Clerk of Maine. I certainly can. She also sits on the commission with me. I will tell you the way I've recorded the vote in Oregon that has now shown up as not a vote is I have put down refused to vote and in violation of House rules. That's the way it will show in the record. Because he wasn't absent.
Yeah.
And he didn't vote aye, and he didn't vote no. He just refused to vote.
Are there other questions for the Chief Clerk? We have her here. Okay, well, thank you very much for enlightening us.
Yes, and I'm going to go ahead and stay just in case anything else comes as you all start thinking.
So, members, I wanted to just also say one more thing that I think is important, that I think, you know, the point of having a rule is that we hope not to have to impose it. You know, I think when we dealt with this situation, we did not know what to do. We really were at a loss, and we were somewhat frozen, and we don't want that to happen again. So we want to have something that I think is clear and certain, and that hopefully will be sufficient that somebody will not do this again. And that's my, I guess, my goal here.
I have another question, if you don't mind, Ramona, if she's still, well, she's still in the chair. You said that before 1999, the rule was that you could abstain with a vote of the body. Did that, has that ever happened? Has that ever happened?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, in my history here, I have never seen it happen. Okay, now I would say that's from 1973 on. Okay, prior to that, I don't know.
So, Madam Chair, so what would be the mechanism of that? You're in the middle of a vote. Somebody says, I'm not going to vote. I want to abstain. Was the mechanism then that the next vote would be a vote on the abstention? And if they still refuse to vote, I mean, I know this is an obscure thing that I'm asking you to kind of pull out, but sort of what happens then if, or do they have to abstain in advance? And if they don't, then we're back to right here.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Berger, it would be my advice that if, in fact, we had the provision where you could abstain, that request would have had to been made before we took the vote, not unlike you having to declare a potential conflict. And that's really what the rule was in there for. Before the ethics rules were put in, and that was sort of started in 1973 session and have grown, okay? But it was really clear, and I know that the Oregon Law Commission has looked at this specifically and thought that maybe people should not be able to vote if they have a conflict of interest. The decision made in 1973 was that the membership still believed that every member should vote because they have a constituency to represent. But they need to declare that conflict. But since they hadn't gone down that path before, they did put in the rules that if, in fact, you had and I think it was for a conflict that it would have been used, that if you have a conflict, it wasn't potential, but an actual conflict, that some members may decide that they would prefer to abstain. So they would have stood and asked that under the House rules that they be allowed to abstain on the next vote, and the explanation would have been given. There would have been decision at that point in time whether they would be allowed to abstain. And then we would have moved to the vote. If they had not been allowed to abstain, then they would have had to vote. But it would have been a decision by the entire membership as to whether or not they would excuse them from that vote.
Thank you. I appreciate the explanation because it really doesn't get us out of this quandary either, clearly.
But it's interesting.
It is interesting. I was looking for some other way out.
Yes, Representative.
I have not so much a question for a moment, but just a reflection in thinking about these options. Thinking about the whole place we're in this is because I think we're all committed to the end goal of having members vote on the floor. The option of punishing that by saying, I think the reason we come to that conclusion is because we think it's important that all Oregonians be represented. Every time there's a vote, that there be a voice and a vote on the floor for them. For someone to violate that, and then our punishment of them to be, if we did consider what apparently is the main model, of further disenfranchising those constituents from having a voice and vote on other subsequent bills, just seems to me to be a very bizarre way of saying it's so bad that those constituents are not represented, that we're going to make sure they're further not represented on the next successive bills until there's an apology. It just doesn't. It strikes me as a very strange punishment for the crime. The other thing that was mentioned earlier, the whole kind of concept that we've talked about in this committee earlier in terms of the double majority election requirement, which currently encourages people not to vote, basically. I think that's very different from this. In an election, nobody has any kind of constitutional or rules requirement that they vote. We as an average voter are not required under the law or rules of the Constitution or anything to vote. As legislators, that's very different. We are required to be here and vote. And so I think, frankly, much like the double majority reform we passed that encourages voters to vote and their votes to count, I think that this rule, either in both of these options that are before us, would head us in that direction.
Thank you. Other comments? Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Reflect on what Representative Hunt just brought forth. I do think there is some validity that if a representative is choosing to defy the House rules, the more that representative is shown to his or her constituency that they are not willing to represent them in the House in a way that is proper, I think that damages them, and they deserve the damage they inflict upon themselves in doing so. I do understand the concern about not representing a constituency, but I think that's one way to communicate to the constituency that you have a representative that should be removed from office.
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
I guess I would look at that aspect similar to what Peter just said. If they're not going to vote in the first place, then they are damaging their constituency. So it's the choice. It will come back and roost.
Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, we find ourselves in a really interesting place in that here is a problem before us that has never occurred before in the history of the state that we know of. And it's one that was inconceivable, and it has presented itself. I guess I'm in some ways questioning whether a problem so rare even requires a rule change of any kind at this point, at all. It may not occur for another 150 years, or further. In my own way, I'm quite uncomfortable with this yes vote being the vote if you don't vote. I have a problem with voting for some, having a constituent vote by rule. In other words, a member is voting for their constituents, on behalf of their constituents. Having the vote be by rule is not a vote, and the refusal also, I agree with Representative Buckley, is something between them and their constituents in a sense that they are not doing their duty. I'm fine for censure. In fact, I wish it were, that's why I like the main thing. It's a little stronger censure. It says more about how bad this is. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that this is a problem that isn't a one-time thing, and do we need to change our rules at all at this point? These are my thoughts. These aren't going anywhere. they're just thoughts.
Can I respond?
Yes. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate what Vice Chair Berger saying. I do think, though, I mean, because this has happened once, it happened under a call of the House, and we found ourselves in a situation of being basically held hostage for 2 hours. The damage that did to the reputation of the legislature, the damage of our ability to work together. I am worried that it could conceivably happen again if emotions rise up. Now someone knows how to do it. Someone knows how to hold the entire process hostage. If they so choose, they can hold the process hostage unless there's a rule in place that allows the speaker to exit that. That process clean. So I think we do have to pass a rule, and it just, if only for this session, to say that we're not going to go back in that direction.
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
I think that when you embark upon this path, that the severity of what you've done to this institution is almost irreparable. Therefore, I think when we talk about severity of penalty, I don't have a problem with putting in a severe penalty. I think that when you choose to hold that body at bay and to take the institution to that level, then I have a real problem with it. I agree with my colleague from Southern Oregon that we do, in fact, need to get something. I'm just not sure what we need to get. But we need to have something in place because, like he just said, now everyone knows how to do this.
Yes, Representative Hunt.
In fact, I've been suspecting that Representative Esquivel will be the next person to take advantage of this.
I'm not voting
today. He is kind of wily. As I thought over the last several days, since these rule changes have been proposed, the whole issue of recording, I think there probably is no perfect option, because since our Constitution requires that there be 31 votes to pass a bill, which is not what all states require. In many states, it would be, and in the federal government, it is a simple majority to pass legislation. That's kind of a unique aspect we have. So if a whole series of us decided to abstain, it doesn't change the 31. The 31 requirement is still there, which is a unique aspect I think we're dealing with. But if we were to, after the fact, decide, well, that person abstained, now we're going to decide retroactively for them how their vote's going to be recorded, I think that would be one very different thing than them knowing ahead of time. If you do this in violation of the rules, your vote will be recorded this way. It's very much like we have various options. We have various ways today. We can vote aye. We can press the green button. We can hold up our thumbs. We can yell out like a pirate, aye, as the good Representative Coos Bay might do. We can put our fingerprint on the fingerprint scanner in the back. This would be one additional way that someone would know they would be recorded as an aye or as a yay. So I think it's very different than if we were to go back and say, well, this person refused to vote. Now, an hour later or a day later, we're going to decide that that's a yes or a no. In this case, we're proactively saying, and the person in violation of the rules would be notified at that point exactly. In fact, even in, as I understand this rule, the instructions from the speaker at that point would specifically be that their vote will be recorded in the affirmative as required by the rules. So I just think, I'm not sure this is the perfect solution. I just think of all the solutions that have been suggested, this is the best one before us, and I agree completely. We've got to do something to address it, because Representative Esquivel is going to take advantage of this any day now if we don't.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too believe we need to do something, and we need to do it now. The only thing that I, two things came to me in the testimony that we had a few minutes ago, and the first one was, I agree with our clerk when it's any rule that's violated, you know, directly. I mean, when you've been warned that this is the rule and then you violate it, not just the voting rules, but I would agree if a person tried to bring people onto the floor who weren't supposed to be there and they were told, no, you can only have this person, and they did it anyway, I think something should happen right then, too, because that disrupts the place, too. The rule we have here doesn't deal with that at all. I mean, it really only takes care of one. And I would just as soon end all of the deals that people would do with respect to the rules. I think we need to do that. And so I'll throw in another one just for people to think about, and that has to do with if you break the rule, you're automatically censured and removed from all committees for the remainder of the term. I mean, if you want to end people playing around with stuff, let's do something that says if you directly violate any rule of the House, you know, after having been explained to the rule and you continue to violate it, then you shall be censured and you shall be dropped from all committees. Now, you aren't taking away the vote, you're not doing the other kinds of things that are issued, but you certainly are telling them that they are not going to be acting as they have been in the remainder of the term, of the session.
You want lethal injection, too?
You're the one that's taking
that. Yeah, this is an interesting idea. I'm not sure any rule would, I mean, I may get a meal that's worth $10.50, and I don't want to be taken off all committees for a $10.50 meal. I'm sorry. That was meant in jest, but you understand. There are some rules that are, but this is one that I think that we all agree is a critical one. And Didn't see in here any states that do that.
I know.
But it is another interesting idea that
I mean, that certainly is an interesting idea. I would assume that the speaker who appoints people to committees also has the authority to remove members from committees if the speaker sees fit, and possibly, you know, within the language here, other penalties might include that too. I don't know whether the body has the authority to do that or whether it's only the speaker. And I see the chief clerk is sitting
here. Yeah, so I have other institutions done that.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, Representative Roblin, all other interested parties. Basically, although the speaker is the appointing authority and has the right to change committees by either removing and or replacing or adding, as long as obviously we're still under the proportional rule. Clearly the House could also see that as an appropriate penalty. And it is something that's happened before in Oregon. And usually it is a decision made only by the speaker, and it has happened when certain individuals of their own caucus have not moved forward typically in a way that deems appropriate in moving the agenda. However, I do believe that, again, those persons who have suffered that or have been given that punishment shows up for floor session but only has then that interaction within the process. And it does make a difference. And it is some, and I believe that the reason why you don't find it in other states is that Oregon is the only one with a real strong committee system. In other states, they amend on the floor. So it wouldn't hurt probably too many people's feelings to be removed from a committee, because the fact of the matter is the committee reports come to the floor and then they're all changed anyway. But in Oregon, since we do not amend on the floor, it's a huge privilege to sit on a committee and be part of fine-tuning legislation for the good of the whole.
Thank you. Well, I think, members, we've had a good discussion. I see two options, because I am persuaded that we do need to do something. I think that's the consensus of most people that I've talked to, and certainly of the members of this committee. We have two versions in front of us now. If members are comfortable voting on one of those, we could do that tonight. Or I'm also willing to carry this over to Friday morning, but to be prepared to vote at that time. I don't really see that we can wait any longer than that. And so if people want more time and feel they need more time to weigh this, then I'm willing to do that. But those, I think, are the two options that I can
see.
And so I'd like to hear what people think about those two choices. And Vice Chair Berger?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I would prefer to reflect a little bit on this and also see if some language around Maine might be put together for consideration Friday, or some language around committees might be put together for Friday. And not necessarily, I mean, this is outside of our usual amendment process, but I guess, in consultation, I would feel more comfortable if we had a little more option along that line, and would prefer Friday, but because this is really tough stuff, and I am persuaded. Representative Buckley's spoke. I put on the table doing nothing deliberately, and I'm kind of glad it was shot down. Okay. Sometimes you put things on the table to see, you know, it shot down. Because I do think we need to move, but I don't think there's any hurry tomorrow. I think everybody's going to vote tomorrow. So, in changing this rule, I would caution just a little more time, if you wouldn't mind, to let me think about what the main language might look like or other options. Okay.
Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your patience. I think it's important, if at all possible, for this committee to send forth a rule that has strong support from the committee as a whole. I would even suggest, I don't know, just for consideration, the idea that perhaps Representative Hunt, who feels very strong about having the record as a yay, but another of us like the main idea, that there might be a way to combine it to record the vote as a yay, censor the member, and have the member suspended from voting and speaking on the floor until the member apologizes. It's kind of all the ideas pulled into one.
I think that I am comfortable. I do want members to be comfortable voting. Oh, yes. Go ahead, Representative Esquivel.
Yes. Representative Robel and I have been chit-chatting here, and we'd like a crack at this. It would be the Roblin Esquivel.
Rather scary, Madam Chair.
Buckley.
Frightening to me.
In fact, it sounds scary to me. But I will go into the lion's den like Daniel with my compadres.
So obviously, members, you are welcome to develop other proposals as you see fit, and I'm sure that the chief clerk would be happy to help you in any way that she can. I just want to make it clear that we will be expecting to vote on some version of this on Friday when we take it up again.
One other comment?
And yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Chair, if we cannot find anything better, I'm happy to vote for the May 9th proposal if we cannot find a better solution.
I'm there as well. So, I mean, I think that it's one of those things that will push all of us to come up with something.
Yeah.
Figure out something.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard enough people say that they would like a little more time to work on this, that I'm going to say that that's what we will do. I think the proper way to do that is to say that we will carry this over until our next meeting, which is Friday morning at 8:30. And with nothing further to come before us, members, thank you for your time and attention, and we are adjourned. Have a good evening.